You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, the new BTK IDES on the block, compelling rationale for non-covalent Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibition in B-cell cancers. I'm Deb Gordon, and I'm thrilled to be joined by Dr. Shazia Nakhoda, Assistant Professor of Malignant Hematology at Fox Chase Cancer Center and Temple Health in Philadelphia. In this podcast, Dr. Nakhoda will address the challenges of first and second generation BTK inhibitors with a focus on resistance and adverse effects. Welcome, Dr. Nakhoda.
Thanks for having me.
So the advent of the covalent BTK inhibitors such as ibrutinib and the second generation inhibitors, acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib, dramatically transformed the treatment landscape of CLL, MCL, and other B-cell malignancies. Let's start with how they work.
The first and second generation BTK inhibitors are covalent inhibitors, meaning they irreversibly bind to the ATP binding site of the Bruton tyrosine kinase receptor, and then this blocks the downstream cascade of B-cell receptor signaling, which would otherwise allow leukemic cell proliferation. Such as NF-kappa-B pathway, and we can see the effects of BTK inhibitors also on the chemokine production and interaction between the leukemic cells and their tumor microenvironment. So we see that outside of the B-cell receptor, these agents do seem to have some effect.
So one problem with them, as we learned, is patients almost always develop resistance. Why does this happen?
Well, one of the most common mechanisms of resistance is mutations to the cysteine 481 residue, which impairs the binding of the covalent BTK inhibitors. Another is a gain of function mutation in the PLC gamma 2 enzyme, which functions just downstream of the BTK. We see that these mutations are present in about 80% of patients with CLL who are resistant to ibrutinib. And several other binding site mutations have now been identified, including L528W and T474I. These mutations actually seem to confer some resistance to the non-covalent BTK inhibitors as well. Of note, these BTK inhibitor binding site mutations are seen most commonly in CLL, but not as commonly identified in other B-cell lymphomas. So this tells us that ibrutinib resistance seems to be mediated by other mechanisms as well. One proposed mechanism is upregulation of other pathways in the B-cell receptor signaling that bypass the BTK inhibition. So notably, we are seeing that the rates of the various BTK inhibitor binding resistance mutations are different amongst the various covalent and non-covalent BTK inhibitors. So ibrutinib and acalabrutinib, the resistance mutation rates seem to be more overlapping, whereas with zanubrutinib, the patients who are resistant to zanubrutinib have higher rates of L258W mutations, and this confers cross-resistance to the non-covalent BTK inhibitors. And this seems to be seen for pirtobrutinib and nemtobrutinib. So with the uptick of the second generation covalent BTK inhibitors being used, and the new covalent BTK inhibitors under development, we'll need to see how these patients respond over time.
So should it be standard that there be genetic testing before determining which agent to start with?
That is a really good question. So we know that in patients who have not yet been treated with a BTK inhibitor, we don't tend to see these mutations. They seem to be acquired during therapy. So it might be hard to predict which patients are going to develop this mutation. But what I think would be really great is at time of resistance, we don't simply do point testing for specific mutations, but we sequence the entire gene because it's important to identify which mutations are being developed so that in the second and third line setting, we can better tailor therapies. We do this in CML, for example, quite routinely. And so I think this may eventually be the trend we see in non-Hodgkin lymphomas.
So can you go a little bit more detail about those other mechanisms?
So in mantle cell lymphoma, for example, we suspect that there are other mechanisms outside the B-cell receptor that seem to drive resistance. For example, upregulation of the NF-kappa-B pathway as an alternative method. Certain mutations seem to predispose patients to resistance that leads to ibrutinib and other covalent BTK inhibitors. And Another consideration may be related to how these drugs bind to highly proliferative diseases. We do know that covalent BTK inhibitors irreversibly bind, and therefore they may not effectively bind to new targets that are being produced after these drugs have already taken effect.
So is it kind of like once they have already bound, when the disease advances or changes in the disease occur, the drugs just aren't available anymore?
That's what we believe is happening, yes.
Are there ways to overcome the resistance with these therapies, or, you know, once resistant to ibrutinib, always resistant to ibrutinib?
Well, that's a great question. One thing we are trying to do in all the different B-cell histologies is looking at combination regimens. So the thought is, by targeting several mechanisms in the B-cell receptor pathway or extrinsic to the B-cell receptor, potentially we can overcome some of the resistance mechanisms that develop. So one thing we're doing is combining BTK inhibitors with anti-CD20 monoclonal antibodies and the BCL2 inhibitor venetoclax. We know that doublet and triplet regimens in CLL induce very high rates of deep responses, but we don't know exactly if these deep responses correlate with longer survival. And so this is an important way of overcoming resistance. Of course, in clinical practice, we need to better understand if these combination regimens that may overcome resistance are worth the added toxicity. Another way of overcoming resistance is novel BTK inhibitors that have been developed. So we have pirtobrutinib and nemtobrutinib, which are currently being studied or are approved. And we know that these agents work a little differently than the covalent BTK inhibitors. They are reversible binders. So we see that they can bind and rebind to new targets that may be produced. We also see that they bind at a different site, so they don't use the C481S residue, and so they're agnostic to this mutation being present or not present and seem to be as effective. And they seem to have very effective pharmacokinetics in terms of being active at therapeutic doses in the bloodstream, which seem to also help with tolerability.
Which kind of brings up an issue with the covalent BTK inhibitors, which is their off-target effects. Let's talk about these and how you manage them in your practice. What do you see? How often does it lead your patients to discontinue? And are there ways to manage them to keep them on these drugs as long as possible?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So one of the biggest issues with covalent BTK inhibitors is toxicity. And while compared to chemoimmunotherapy, these are generally a more favorable side effect profile, there are some unique toxicities that seem to be driven at least in part due to the off-target effects, such as the EGFR, TEC, and ITK kinases that also can be hit by these drugs. And we know that issues like atrial fibrillation, hypertension, bleeding, rash, infection, and musculoskeletal pain can all be reasons for discontinuation of this drug. The second generation BTK inhibitors, acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib, have less off-target binding, and both agents have better side effect profiles compared to ibrutinib. So I'll preferentially choose these agents over ibrutinib when I'm trying to mitigate side effect risk, particularly the risk of atrial fibrillation. Oftentimes, dose reduction or a brief treatment break can greatly improve the side effects. Supportive medications for bothersome side effects like caffeine for headaches, steroids, or acetaminophen for musculoskeletal symptoms can be very helpful. And I make sure my patients are advised that these agents need to be held perioperatively because they have antiplatelet effects. So if a patient is high risk for cardiac issues or with known atrial fibrillation, I'll often reach out to their cardiologist and work with them in making a treatment plan for them.
Good. Is there still a place for ibrutinib, or would you not start with the two second generation?
In general, I am choosing acalabrutinib and or zanubrutinib for patients because of the toxicity profiles. I think historically we were struggling to know what to do because the longest follow-up data really did come from ibrutinib. But now we have some pretty long follow-up data from acalabrutinib, And I think this does support that the added benefit of a improved toxicity profile did not seem to sacrifice on efficacy.
So let's sort of wrapping it up, what advice would you give clinicians who treat these patients about the use of covalent inhibitors?
Well, the new covalent BTK inhibitor pirtobrutinib seems to have a very favorable side effect profile. And this is including patients who were previously intolerant to a covalent BTK inhibitor. In the phase one study, we saw no treatment-related development of atrial fibrillation, and nearly all the rates of bleeding were grade one or two. These are particularly important side effects for me. Treatment-related grade three or four toxicities were less than 1%, except for neutropenia, which was seen in 5% of patients, and generally this can be easily managed. In cross-trial comparison, this seems to be a very well-tolerated agent. Nemtabrutinib is another covalent BTK inhibitor, but this seems to have some more off-target binding than pirtobrutinib, though the toxicity profile also seemed to be manageable. In terms of efficacy, we now have phase two data to show that pirtobrutinib overcomes resistance to prior BTK inhibitors, and this seems to be with or without C481 mutations. It's now approved in mantle cell lymphoma, and we're hopeful it'll be approved in CLL in the near future.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much. That's all the time we have for today. I want to thank you, Dr. Nakoda, for taking the time to speak with us about the challenges of first and second generation BTK inhibitors. And I want to thank our audience for joining us. We have several other episodes in this series, and we hope you'll be listening to all of them. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide CME for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would like to give a special thank you to our supporter, Lily, who provided an educational grant for this activity.